Welcome to Inside Property. I'm Richard Blanco. First foot on the property ladder. Today we're looking at the challenges faced by people buying their first property, be it for owner occupation or as an investment. We'll be hearing from two case studies. Earlier I spoke to our first contributor.
I'm Laura. I'm 36 tomorrow. I was living with my mum for 5 years because I had a baby and split up with his father. And initially, because I was on maternity leave, I absolutely couldn't afford to rent anywhere. So, especially because we'd separated and we weren't living together anymore. So I had really no choice but to move back to my mum's. And then because I returned to work only 3 days a week, because I was paying over £900 a month in nursery fees on my own, again, I was sort of in a position where I really couldn't afford to do anything. I've recently gone back to work full time, as well as my mum selling her own property, which has enabled me to have some income from that. Mum's lent me or given me a bit of money from the sale of her home, which has enabled me to, well, initially I wanted to buy somewhere, but I found that very difficult. So I've gone into renting, private renting for a little while, to sort of find my feet before I figure out what my next move is.
Let me just unpack that a bit more, Laura. So your mum sold her property to give you a deposit. Where's she living now then?
So my mum bought a property in Crouch End in 1985 for £57,000. She's been in that property since 1985 and it's now worth £950,000. My mum is 66, so she's at a point where she has decided to downsize, and she wanted to move to a flat while she was still healthy and not in a position where she needed to move because she couldn't get up the stairs anymore. So she wanted to do all of that anyway, but she also wanted to help me and my sister. My sister's just had a baby. So she's moving within the same area, but to a two-bedroom flat rather than a four-bedroom house. So she's sold the house for £950, and she's moving into a property that's worth £525. So my sister and I are both going to get £180,000 each.
Fantastic. And have you found that that goes very far in London in terms of deposit, Laura?
I found that because I'm on my own and they'll only lend me four times my income, which is £42,000, I am struggling because I need to get a two-bedroom property because I have a child. I could probably just about afford a one-bed flat in London, but because I'm looking for a two-bed, even with a £180,000 deposit, I'm finding that I'll probably only be lent around 116, I think it was, or maybe slightly more than that. It was about 127 with Halifax, which doesn't bring me up to the mark of what I would need to purchase something in the area that I need to be in. Because, you know, it's all very well. I could probably go to Ilford or Barking or somewhere and get something. But my son is settled in a school, and it's really important to me to not unsettle him. It's a bit of a catch-22, really. I can't afford to stay in this area, but I need to stay in this area because of my family, childcare commitments and school. So I'm finding it really tough.
We'll be hearing from Laura again later in the programme, but let me introduce my guests. Jay Rooney is a financial advisor at One and All Financial and joins us from Manchester. Investment coach Damien Fogg from the epinvestor.com is on the line from Chester. And in Newark, MD from Property Checklist, Kate Faulkner. Now, Kate, let me ask you first of all to respond to what we heard there from Laura about the affordability picture across the UK. What is it like? We heard that Laura there is struggling and she's got this £180,000 from her mum.
Yeah, it sounds crazy, doesn't it, really, that with that level of deposit that she's struggling. But certainly she's looking in Crouch End. That is going to be tricky. I'm sure she would be able to look at doing shared ownership. So that's what I would look for in her particular case. I've just been doing some work on a first-time buyer two-bed property in Nottingham. Costs a grand total of £90,000, so she could have two of those here. And, of course, if you're a first-time buyer, that means a deposit at 5%, because I think a lot of first-time buyers, I find, think they have to have a huge deposit, and you don't. 5% is a good starter for 10 if you can get that together. And, of course, the government will contribute 25% to your deposit savings as well. So it does really depend on where you are in the country, but there is, without question, a kind of Midlands upwards is not too bad, but anything south of that is tricky.
And Jay, what mortgage hurdles do first-time buyers face?
I think the biggest hurdle first-time buyers face in the current day is the lack of deposit, as has already been mentioned. The secondary biggest hurdle they face, Richard, are what Laura's already mentioned, what we used to call the income multiplier, what we now call the affordability calculation. The vast majority of inquiries that we receive are for people that have perhaps already been to their own bank, but they're not going to lend them enough money, or they're just very uncompetitive. As I say, 9 out of 10 residential mortgage inquiries we receive from somebody like Laura these days, it's all about, well, I've already spoken to ABC, or I've spoken to my bank, what can you do for me? Because I'm trying to maximise my loan amount. Can I just clarify something? Because I missed what Laura said. Did Laura say that her income is £42,000 a year?
Yes, I think she did.
The reason why I asked the question is I know that she suggested Halifax would only lend her a mere 120,000 pounds, or 116,000 or 115,000. It was something just above 100,000. There are lenders out there that would lend her significantly more, right up to anywhere between 4.5, 4.8 times her income, which would take her up to nearly £200,000. Now, that may still not get her to where she wants to be, but with a sizable deposit of £180,000, that helps enormously. There's no doubt about it. It means that her products will be a lot less than what they would be if she only had, say, a 5% deposit, because, frankly, 95% mortgages are incredibly uncompetitive compared to the 70, 75, 80, 85% loan-to-value counterparts.
And, of course, that's one of the advantages of talking to a broker, isn't it, Jay, that you can look at the whole of the market and see what else is out there. I wanted to ask you actually about guarantor or even rent-a-room mortgages. Are those the sorts of things that people should be looking at, or are they not around anymore? What's the picture regarding those?
Rent a room is still incredibly niche, and we're only aware of three lenders. There may be more, but we're only aware of three lenders that will consider this sort of thing. One being the Bath Building Society, and they'll consider that up to something like 80% loan to value, and they will consider it for a purchase. The Melton Mowbray Building Society will consider it in certain cases, but it's underwriter discretion. And then on the high street, the likes of Santander, they will take it into account. But unfortunately, it's only going to work for people who want to remortgage their home, because Santander insists on seeing 3 months evidence of receipt of that rent-a-room income. So it just doesn't work for first-time buyers. Guarantors, more so. The guarantor mortgage market took a big hit following the mortgage market review in 2014, where lenders had to take ages into account a lot more. Gone were the days of the income multiplier, where you would take somebody's income and just multiply it by 3.5 to 4.5, maybe even as much as 5%. Lenders still do that, of course, provided you've got a good 25, 30 years left before retirement. But whenever you're closer to a normal retirement age, lenders have to reduce the amount they would loan significantly. And the big problem with guarantors are the vast majority of them don't tend to be a brother or sister who are a couple of years older than the applicant. The vast majority of them tend to want to be family members, and specifically mother or father, who can help. There are a number of lenders out there that will consider guarantor mortgages up to the age of 85 for the oldest borrower. But the problem what I'm having is, and I don't know how old Laura's mother is, for example, but most of the guarantor inquiries that I receive from potential new clients, their parents are already in their late 50s or early 60s, which means it's going to restrict the length of mortgage to perhaps as little as 15 to 20 years. And then the mortgage payments themselves become unaffordable, because the individual who wants to purchase the property can't afford to repay a mortgage over such a short period of time compared to what they would have been able to do if they were able to take it out themselves. So in Laura's case, because she's only 36 or 36 tomorrow, she could have a 33-year mortgage with the majority of the market. In fact, there are some that would even let her take it to the age of 75. Now, whether that's responsible or not, I'll let somebody else answer. But certainly, the likes of the NatWest, Halifax, Santander, Barclays, they would all allow Laura to take a mortgage over 33 years. If Laura tried to include her mother, And let's say for a moment her mother's in her early 60s. Well, suddenly that reduces the term down to anywhere between 15 and 20 years.
Now, Kate, the government are very keen on their Help to Buy policy, and you mentioned that earlier on. Can you tell us a bit more about how that's working and, you know, how popular it is?
Sure, it's actually been very popular, and obviously always things like any government policy will attract critics. But in actual fact, I think it's been a great policy. It came in 2013. Just the announcement of the policy actually turned the property market from one that was very much into the doldrums to getting people out and actually starting to realise that it was okay to buy property again after the crash. So the principle is that basically it's not easy to get on the ladder if you're a first-time buyer. As a result, they also want to encourage building, new build, and to do that you have to sort of almost guarantee demand for developers. So the idea is that the government, if you've only got a 5% deposit, for example, then you can up that to a 25% deposit thanks to a free 20% loan from the government, which lasts for 5 years, and then you pay a small amount after that. That is available on new build only. So outside of London, it's extraordinarily popular, whereas inside of London, it's still a tough thing to purchase, partly because there aren't enough new builds, but secondly, a new build price is pretty expensive. You're talking entry price, probably £350, £400, whereas in the Midlands, where I am, for example, you could quite easily get on the ladder here, the average first-time buyer, and that's the average, pays around £150,000, similar in Birmingham. So it's much more accessible, if you like, to buy new build, and I think places like the Midlands, Yorkshire and Humber have been very, very popular for Help to Buy. But what's actually really good about it, it's encouraged young people to change the culture away from old Victorian homes being the best thing ever to buy, to actually buying new build and liking new build. And that's one of the things that we need to have, that kind of culture, if we're going to sort of build our way out of the housing crisis.
Interesting, because from an investor perspective, I often wonder whether new builds are a good idea, because often you're paying a premium and you're also paying management fees. What do you think about that, Damien? Do you recommend that investors buy new builds?
I mean, it's quite hard to say exactly whether or not this is the best idea for them. New builds, as you say, do tend to have a bit of a premium attached to them. You're buying that shiny object. So, as Kate says, if we can change attitudes so that all of a sudden it becomes more popular, more acceptable to live in newer houses, whether or not that's linked as well to the fact that new build houses tend to be smaller and slightly less desirable, I think that in itself needs to be addressed. But you've got this whole issue of the leaseholds, which have come out recently, a lot of new build flats, which is what first-time buyers can afford. There are negative implications and things attached to them that has been brought about by the whole investor mentality of how can we possibly squeeze every pound of profit out of them, that is a little bit negative and isn't helpful, I think.
Let's move on now to focus a little bit more on first-time investors. According to the National Landlords Association, the long-term trend prior to recent tax changes was for around 100,000 new landlords to come into the business every year. Let's hear from our second case study now.
My name is Jack Rolfe, I'm 29, I work in sales in a gym and I live near Walthamstow.
And Jack, tell us a bit about your situation property-wise. Where are you living?
So I currently live with my girlfriend. We're in a three-bed flat I bought about 4 years ago.
So you've actually got onto the property ladder, haven't you? But you're wanting to become a landlord, is that right?
I had looked into it. It's what I'd wanted to do for a long time. I read a lot about it. My stepfather and his eldest son did it while I was young. And I used to go and spend my summers working, renovating their places that they did. So I always thought it would be a good long-term investment.
And how did you manage to get on the property ladder in the first place? Because you've owned a place for 4 years.
So I was very lucky. My grandfather left me some money in his will.
Oh, okay, fantastic. And did that pay for the whole property or just the deposit? Or
about half of the property.
Right, brilliant. So you got that sort of helping hand.
Yeah.
And has the property appreciated in value?
Yes, it's done quite well.
So what size property do you have?
It's a three-bed flat.
Okay, and I understand you're going to try and take some equity out to buy a rental property. Is that right, Jack?
Yeah, so I've actually decided to sell it this time and downsize. So I'm going to buy something with my girlfriend. So I actually be able to release a bit more than I would have just by myself. And we'll buy a little one bed flat, and then I'll use that money to hopefully make an investment.
And how easy are you finding it getting finance on your first rental property?
Well, I initially tried 2 years ago and found it very, very difficult. It wasn't going to happen. I believe I could do it now, but having sort of looked into things 2 years later, I feel that it might not be the right decision for me. I'm looking to change tack and maybe go into a development strategy instead. Try and find an area that I think is doing well and go there rather than stay in London, as it seems things might be stagnant for a little while.
Now, the environment for landlords has been made much more difficult by changes in the tax regime and also by changes in the regulation of buy-to-let mortgages. It was much easier for people like myself who bought many years ago. How are you feeling about all of that?
It's made things a lot more difficult. Going through the margins with my stepdad, it's cut the margins on what he has a lot. It's made me look to not look that way, and to look towards renovations instead of long-term investment in rentals.
So you're
for
looking,
now at least.
You're looking at buying to sell then, is that the idea?
Yes, that's the plan.
Now, Laura, you were also considered buying to let somewhere in the Midlands or the north of England rather than buying a property for yourself, didn't you? Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that actually, you know, with £180,000, I would be in a position to just buy a property outright, probably anywhere else outside of London. But obviously, I'm not going to be in a position to move outside of London because of my family commitments. So I thought perhaps it might be the more sensible way to get onto the property ladder and to have, a guaranteed income from that. And when I was looking into it, I was just finding that I don't know enough about it. It all felt very scary to me to be potentially, you know, purchasing a property that was hundreds of miles away from me in an area that I didn't really know or understand. So I looked into some companies. Obviously, I'm a complete novice at this, so I was just kind of Googling, and then I had all these different companies. I must have put my email address down somewhere weird on my phone number, and then I had all these companies contacting me to say, you know, we are property managers. We've got all these properties up in Sheffield or whatever. You buy it, you've got a guaranteed income of 18 grand a year or whatever it was, and it felt like there was this really hard sell, and I contacted you actually, Richard, to say what do we think of all this? And there was definitely that sense of if it sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. So again, I feel like, you know, I don't have any knowledge of this subject, and I also don't have time to really gain enough knowledge. I'm working full time, I've got a child, and I'm also setting up my own business on the side. So I'm pretty much working two full time jobs, and to then take on a commitment of having to learn about an entirely new industry was, again, it just felt like too much. You know, I don't think you could go into buy to let with, you know, just a load of money and a great idea. I think you really have to know what you're doing, and I really don't. So again, it felt like this could potentially be me throwing away $180,000, and I was too terrified to do that.
So Damien, Laura, very much put off there by the prospect of buying to let. I mean, what sort of process might you have taken her through if she'd come to you?
I think Laura is very rare in that she is actually looking at this property investment side of it as a real business. Far too many people think, well, I've been inside a house before, therefore getting into property is going to be dead easy and straightforward. So, I mean, A, happy birthday for Laura for tomorrow, but also really commend her for realizing that it is a whole new business that you're getting into. For someone who is in her position that potentially can't afford to buy where she wants to live, but can afford to buy investment properties elsewhere, there's an element of geo-arbitrage, which is something I've personally done, where you effectively buy properties for rental purposes in a higher yielding area than you want to live that has a lower yielding area. So as she said, buying up in Leicester, for example, and renting in London, from a pure financial perspective, it does make quite a lot of sense. Now, there are so many sharks in the property industry and so many people that just want to take your money off you. And maybe they've done a weekend long course and they now pitch themselves as property sources and all this stuff. So you've got to do a huge amount of due diligence on anybody that you're going to be giving potentially £180,000 to.
Damien, I was just going to say, do you think buy-to-let is now basically a kind of Southwest Midlands and Northerners market in England, and that, you know, people are just not looking so much now in London and the Southeast because of prices?
Yes, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think you touched on it earlier when we were talking about sort of the Laura scenario, and house prices in general are just too high. The whole where wages are and where house prices are, they're at a very high rate, and potentially it's unsustainable. Now, the UK as a nation, we're obsessed with house ownership. Prices, even though they arguably should drop significantly, they probably never will, because if you own a house and it's worth, or in your head it's worth 400 grand, you're just not going to accept 300 grand for it. You will wait until the market will give you that number that you have in your head. And the generations, the older generations, my parents and etc., they're not in that desperate need. So they're not being forced out. So I think prices are just potentially too high in the London Southeast area. So yes, the only way it makes sense, all of these changes that the government are bringing in about taxation, the lenders and the numbers that they're making you jump through and prove that the rent sufficiently covers the mortgage costs at a much higher interest rate, I actually don't think that's a bad thing. It's stopping the purely speculative investors going into the property market, and it's forcing people to actually buy solid cash flowing investment properties that make sense as an investment, as opposed to the people that sort of in the early 2000s were buying it on the basis of it'll probably go up 10-20% in the next year or two, that'll do. It's removing that gambling element. So yeah, absolutely, I think Midlands, Birmingham upwards is probably, there will always be individuals properties that sort of go against this rule, but for the most part, yeah, the Northwest, the Northeast, that's where you're getting the higher yielding properties. That's where it makes the most sense to become a buy-to-let investor at the moment, given all of the tax scenarios and all of the lending criteria that you've got to jump through.
And I would just say, think long and hard before buying property a long way from home, because you're going to have to work with agents and you can't just pop over there in an emergency. So, you know, it can be a lot more involved than people think sometimes.
I mean, on that though, there are, obviously, if you have a good agent, they can do a lot of the work on your behalf. If you plan to be very hands-on with your tenants and with the property, then yeah, absolutely, you need to be able to get to the property quickly. It's very possible. I know investors that live overseas. I personally have owned some houses I've never seen before, and I'm a building surveyor, so I'm quite obsessed with knowing the ins and outs of properties. I think it can be done arm's length and hands-off. But you absolutely, I think you're right, you've got to trust the people that are going to be working with you. And so Laura reaching out to you as an expert in the industry is a very sensible step to take.
You're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, and my guests are financial advisor Jay Rooney, investment coach Damien Fogg, and MD of Property Checklist Kate Faulkner. Now, Jay, who will lend to first-time landlords and indeed developers or aspiring developers like Jack? And how do they get over those sort of criteria hurdles?
Well, Jack and Laura are in two different positions. Obviously, Jack is currently a homeowner. That automatically opens extra options for him. However, by the sounds of things, Jack doesn't want to purchase property to let it out over a short, medium or long term. Jack wishes to purchase property to perhaps renovate or refurbish and then sell it onwards, perhaps with his father, I think he mentioned. Well, unfortunately, there are really very few mortgage products available in the market today that offer that particular strategy. One I can think of off the top of my head, Saffron Building Society, that offer a refurbishment product that has a one-year tie-in. The reason why, Saffron understands that people will either want to refinance it onto a more competitive buy-to-let mortgage, or will want to perhaps sell the property onwards, where they will allow you to purchase the property even if it's in a very poor condition, provided you give them a good schedule of works and they understand, and their surveyor more importantly understands that it's all possible and it's a credible strategy. They will lend up to 75-80% of the initial price of the property, and then they will release a further amount of money once the renovation work has taken place if the property's worth more, which of course it should be. Bar that Safran product, then you're going back down the traditional short-term finance route, what we used to call in the industry a bridging loan. And there's no reason why he couldn't get a bridging loan, no reason in the world why he couldn't get a bridging loan. But unfortunately, most of the short-term lenders don't really like offering development funding unless you've got experience in developing. And it just sounds like Jack doesn't have that level of experience.
There are quite a lot of new commercial lenders in the market, though, aren't there, Jay, which is quite interesting at the moment.
There are. And one of those commercial lenders, for example, and they're a great commercial lender, we try to do as much business with them as we can. They're good for complex buy-to-let and commercial, the likes of Shawbrook Bank. But Shawbrook Bank will not provide a short-term loan, a bridging loan, if you like, unless you have had recent experience in the past 2 years of developing property or at least refurbishing a property. That's why it's very difficult to jump from homeowner straight into property developer. The easier stepping stone is to go from homeowner to landlord and then foray into property development. Lenders are much more, what's the word I'm looking for? They're much more comfortable with lending to an experienced landlord who has decided they'd like to make the next step, being purchase property to renovate and then to sell on.
Lenders are wary of veiled self-cert, aren't they, which is where somebody gets a buy-to-let mortgage and then they actually move into the property. Has that sort of thing more or less been stamped out these days?
I think so. I think there's a major lender who I won't name, where the Financial Conduct Authority went in September 2012 and they told them they had 6 months to sort it out or they were coming back to shut them down, because there were many, many files they were plucking where the FCA auditor were saying to said underwriter, how do you know that this wasn't a veiled self-cert, and given the profile? And then the said lender, many lenders followed suit as they were a market leader, decided to create something called the plausibility test. In other words, using one's common sense. So if you are, for example, a first-time buyer or even a homeowner who has decided they'd like to purchase a lovely property that perhaps has a very low rental yield, but a very nice property, and you've got a big deposit in the area in which you live in, are you an experienced landlord? That's a big question that has to be asked. And if you're not, well, then the lender will be asked to probably step back from that, because they'll say, well, in fact, there's too great a risk here for you to decide to move into the property at some point in the future. So I'm afraid it's not for us. And then you've got other lenders like RBS NatWest that have a rule of thumb. We'll just never lend you more than 4.99 times your income. That way, that safeguards us against any veiled self-cert mortgages, which isn't a bad move, which is why they're probably the prime choice for somebody like Laura if she decided to foray into the buy-to-let market rather than the residential market. However, there's a lot Laura could do with that $180,000. You know, going back to the Help to Buy, that was mentioned by Kate a little while ago, 40% in the London area. Laura could purchase a £500,000 flat, get a £200,000 equity loan from the Treasury, put down a £100,000 deposit, get herself a £200,000 mortgage, and even after she'd paid her stamp duty and legal costs, she'd still have £60,000 left over to invest in a buy-to-let property somewhere up north if that's what she wanted to do.
Interesting. So quite a lot of options for her. Now, Kate, one of the issues facing Jack, the PRA and changes and tax restrictions that landlords are having to deal with, that's mortgage changes that have been brought in by the Prudential Regulation Authority. Now, Countrywide, in a recent survey, said that only 1 in 10 properties went to landlords in July 2017. And in the first 6 months of 2017, 21% of first-time buyers said they were competing with a landlord buyer, whereas that was 39% in 2015. Are you picking up that there are fewer landlord investors around, Kate?
We're picking up quite a mixed picture, actually. So they've definitely gone quieter. But I have to say, if they're in the market, I think then they're still quite busy in the market, particularly in areas where you can sort of pick up a little bit of a bargain if you know what you're doing in this sort of market. So to some extent, yes, investors have dropped out, but I think we kind of are calling investors sort of as if they're one beast, if you like, and they're not. There's lots of different types of investors. So one of the things that I think that are dropping out are maybe the accidental landlords from the past that maybe would actually look to sell their property and or were looking to move on, and rather than sell the property, they would let that out and then buy a new one. And I think we're missing a lot of that, so people just adding that extra property to their portfolio, which was their home. So I think the serious investors are still staying in the market and they're still pretty active, whereas those that were kind of dabbling in it, and we are talking about sort of anything up to 80% of people just owning one extra property, then it is that bit of the market that's disappearing. So I think there is, I think there are more first-time buyers out there than there were before as well. Certainly, looking at the stats, they're doing pretty, they're pretty good. But I think actually, when you talk to investors, there's quite a few of them that are just quite fed up at this moment in time as well, because they feel they've kind of been demonised and perhaps unfairly as well. So they're almost like, well, what's the point? This is so much hassle now. You've got 400 rules and regulations to abide by. And I've got all of this, you know, they want to incentivize me to invest in financial products as opposed to property. So I'm going to get taxed. And I don't know what's coming around the corner either. So we won't know for 2 or 3 years really the impact of the policy. The danger is that come the end of January, when people get their tax returns and realize that they're not getting their relief on mortgage interest and that's going down, is that actually we may start seeing a bit of a sell-off next year. It has been predicted, but we certainly aren't picking that up yet. And it's more that I would worry about really rather than the number of landlords coming into the market.
The National Landlords Association often argues that first-time buyers don't buy the same properties as landlords anyway, so landlords are not really directly competing with first-time buyers. What do you say to that, Kate?
I agree. I mean, in the main, let's remember, it's the seller that chooses the buyer. So if a seller chooses a buyer because for some reason an investor, which I never quite understand, is buying for cash versus a first-time buyer that doesn't know what they're doing, then that may well be one reason why people, first-time buyers, do find themselves competing and perhaps losing out to what I would call an accidental investor, because no investor in their right mind would push a price up of a property or compete against it with a first-time buyer, because that would sort of ruin the point of being an investor in the first place. This idea that if you reduce buy-to-let investors, first-time buyers will magically be able to find money, they haven't got their own magic money tree. So we look at a two-bed property in Oxford, it's £400,000. You can rent that for £1,250 a month, so if there's two of you, that's not a bad rental. If you've got to buy that property and you've got to find 50 grand in your back pocket, and you actually, you're albeit that you're paying a repayment mortgage, and particularly if it's a flat in London, you'll be paying an awful lot more than £1,250 a month to purchase that property, and then you've got the maintenance, and then you are tied into that property. So I don't believe that the policy of reduced buy-to-let investors and first-time buyers will magically start buying homes. I don't actually believe that will happen.
And the...
Can I just come in on that, Richard?
Yeah, sure.
I agree an awful lot of what you're saying, Kate. And the example you've just used in Oxford, that's a great example of how that just doesn't help at all. Unfortunately, said £400,000 property that you mentioned is going to require a very large deposit because of the relatively weak rental yield of £1,250 a month that it'll produce. And in the areas of Greater Manchester, that were our local areas, we're noting the more affluent areas, the investors have pulled back on purchasing the properties that perhaps have a better opportunity to increase in value over the coming years, but have a relatively weak rental yield. But on the other hand, we are finding more and more first-time buyers are coming to the table in lieu of landlords that could be purchasing properties not at the very end of the sector, which in Greater Manchester would be £60,000-£70,000 houses, but somewhere around the £120,000-£220,000 mark, where the first-time buyers are managing to cobble together a 5-10% deposit, normally with help from parents, and they do want to become homeowners. They're driven by the vast majority of people I come across are driven by the desire to become a homeowner as opposed to being a tenant, because they want that peace of mind of owning their own home. There's no doubt about it. We're seeing fewer and fewer inquiries for buy-to-let mortgages, other than certain sectors, you know, serious, as I would call a serious professional landlord, and more first-time buyers coming to the market. And I often remark to myself, maybe George Osborne got what he wanted, because there's no doubt about it, happy landlords don't buy a government, but happy first-time buyers and happy next-time buyers, that helps you remain in office.
Well, yes, lots of evidence that George Osborne's intentions are being achieved. And Kate, I wondered what you thought about the talking about winning votes, the changes in the budget for first-time buyers, where they pay 0% now up to 300,000. Some people say that it will push up house prices. I've seen figures of it's only going to help 3,500 first-time buyers. Do you think it's a good move by the government? Is it good for first-time buyers?
It's one of those things where I wish they'd done it about 10 years ago, really, because the problem when you keep changing stamp duty is actually you keep interfering in the market, and then you get artificial moves. So they will have upset an awful lot of people that have already bought this year who paid stamp duty, whereas they'll have made everybody sort of moving onward who doesn't pay stamp duty, they'll have made them a lot happier. However, what I find quite ironic, actually, is that I've always said first, stamp duty is not that much money unless you're a first-time buyer buying in London or in parts of the South East. Here you're talking about a few hundred pounds in the Midlands, typically for a first-time buyer to have to pay. And interestingly, suddenly the media, who've shouted for saying, we must stop and it's not fair to charge stamp duty, now they're all saying, oh, well, it's not really helping anybody anyway. So it's a little bit of a case that, certainly as far as the media concerned, is the political side can't win. My view is that, you know, it's better to pay tax on the way in than on the way out of a property, and you have to pay tax somewhere along the lines. So I think what it will do is one of those things where actually I think it will reduce the amount of bank of mum and dad, which we very rarely talk about. We talk about buy-to-let investors and how they're causing, or in theory causing, a problem in the market. I think bank of mum and dad have pushed prices up far more because of the money that they've ploughed back into the market on behalf of their kids than, for example, buy-to-let investors. That is an assumption, a sort of real, let's put it out there, it'd be lovely if somebody could go and do the research on that. So I actually think it's the parents that will save, because they won't end up having to give their kids quite as much to get on the ladder. Or they might give them a little bit more of a deposit. I hope it doesn't result in prices going up anymore. Obviously, we'll have to monitor that. We're going into a period where prices aren't expected to rise too much, so hopefully there won't be huge amounts of pressure. So I think politically it's been a good move. And I think what it'll do is encourage more first-time buyers to go out who think they can't afford a property, because that's what's shoved down their throats every 5 minutes, who actually can afford the property. So I get very frustrated here in the Midlands, and certainly when we're talking about properties, you know, in Manchester, 60, 70, 80, 90 grand. When you actually talk to people in Manchester or talk to people in Nottingham who are saying they can't get on the ladder, actually they've never even bothered to look. And they don't understand what the costs are, and they don't understand how cheap it is to own a home, and what actually little in some circumstances they have to save. So they tend to put it then into a posh car. So for me, if it encourages people, a bit like the Help to Buy scheme did, to actually think, well, maybe I could afford to buy, now I don't have to pay this huge stamp duty amount, then, and it makes them run the figures, then that's what I think is good. But actually, I have a feeling that Bank of Mum and Dad are the real beneficiaries.
And maybe it's about winning their votes too, who knows? Yes. Damien, can I just ask you about a slightly different topic, but it was brought up by Jack, this issue of the role of property clubs offering deals that look too good to be true. You know, I see lots of them when I go to the Property Investor Show at Excel. Is it buyer beware?
Absolutely. So the vast majority of them need absolute full due diligence carrying out on them. The claims that they make could well be legitimate, but I think, as you say, if it looks too good to be true, there's a good chance it is. What is the catch? A lot of these guaranteed income offers tend to be, it's a case of, we'll look into the company. Is the company going to be there for the next 5, 6, 7 years to actually be around to pay that guaranteed return? There are lots of these buyers clubs that offer things like hotel rooms and student pods that you can buy into, which, yeah, we have a student population that is fairly stable. But you're never going to sell that to a first-time buyer or an owner-occupier. So you only ever have the investor market to exit that particular strategy on. So it almost becomes a commercial investment. And so you need to look at it more from a, well, what's the yield that I'm going to receive from it? And what's the appetite for that type of investment across the board? So I think when people start offering probably 8% plus, you've got to think that comes with a significant element of risk. And a lot of people don't carry out sufficient due diligence to realize where that risk actually lies and whether it is with the sort of the counterparty risk of will that company still be around, or is it a slightly sketchier end of the market they're renting to? So on paper, yes, that's the yield you'd get. But in reality, you're going to have so many void periods or maintenance issues or things like that, that the number you get in reality is quite different.
I don't know if I can come in there, Richard.
Yes, do, Kate,
please,
yes.
Please, I have spent a lot of time dealing with people that have been caught out by these guys because they haven't done their due diligence. And you should never, the amount of people, and I have to say it is a real London thing, that look to hand over cash for a property or buy from somebody in Sunderland or in Stoke-on-Trent or areas like that, whereby you have to have pounded those streets, you have to have talked to all of those agents. You need a really good surveyor by your side that knows that area like the back of their hand and understands property values, or what appears to you to be a cheap property because it's under £100,000. If you're a Londoner, don't believe that that's a good value property, and don't ever believe the figures that you've done. I spent a lot of time analysing the potential discounts that are being given. I use very well respected local agents who know what they're talking about. I have yet to find somebody that has actually advertised or delivered what I would consider, and my research says that it actually offers a decent discount. And the thing about guaranteed income is that's a very, very important point.
Okay.
Well, I think as well, just carrying on from that one, if any of these buyers clubs or sourcing agents or anything are still going on about and selling the below market value, which is very often a sales pitch, a sales tactic, that in itself is a bit of a warning sign for me. There is sort of, the RICS have a definition of exactly what is the market value of a property. And very often when someone says, well, it's a 100 grand house that we're going to sell to you BMV for 80,000 below market value. So the people that they're advertising to think they're going to get an instant £20,000 equity. What they fail to mention, as Kate's just mentioned, either it's actually only worth 80,000 in the first place, or it's worth 100,000, but you've got to put £18,000-£19,000 worth of work in to get it valued at that 100,000. So by buying it at 80, you're actually getting a £1,000 discount. You could probably have just turned up yourself and negotiated that. So I think the use of the sales tactics and the marketing blurb of BMV, that in itself to me sets alarm bells ringing.
Okay, well, I wanted us to come back to shared ownership, which Kate mentioned earlier. Before I do, Laura's experience really put her off, and I'm interested to hear your response.
I was really close to getting a shared ownership property. There's a new build really close to my son's school, and I looked at the properties that were available, and, I mean, they were all extremely expensive, but it was giving me an option, because actually if I put down 180, that could purchase me, you know, 30% of the property, and then I would just have been paying rent. But I didn't feel like it was a very sensible option for me. I was really close to you know, signing contracts and putting the money down, but I read loads online about shared ownership and the pitfalls, and lots of issues around people suddenly having massive surges in their service charges or their rents, and there being very little that they're able to do about it once they're in that. You know, if the housing association say we want to put the rent up by £200 a month, they can just do that. So that kind of freaked me out a little bit, and it also freaked me out that I didn't feel that the properties were worth what they were being sold for. You know, they were like between 550 and 640,000 for these really quite small new build two bedroom flats, which weren't ideal. They weren't what I would have spent 600,000 on if I, you know, for 600,000 actually I could get a really decent flat out here. So the comparative of what was available for that price on shared ownership compared to, you know, what you'd get for an actual flat. I just didn't feel like I would be getting good value for money, and I felt like I was being sort of forced into that position just because I wanted to feel like I owned something. But actually owning 30% of something that's not really great quality or what my heart feels, and also being in a situation where anything could change at any time in terms of the rent and the service charges, I just didn't feel very secure. The vibe and the energy of the whole thing was just, it just didn't sit right with me at all.
So, Kate, I wanted to ask you a bit about the pros and cons of shared ownership and how it works. And we hear there from Laura that she's not very keen on it at all.
Sure. I'm really sad about that, to be honest. If you go online and look at anything, you'll find some bad stuff about it. So I think that, unfortunately, firstly, the government's been very, very poor, as have housing associations, to some extent, of explaining what shared ownership is. So I speak to a lot of people who think you are actually physically sharing the property with somebody else. At least Laura understands that that's not what you do.
Right,
so
right.
She's got that. But the reality is that I think there's a lot of things to cut through here. So what she was explaining about with the service charges, etc., was buying into a leasehold property. Now, she would have that if she was buying £400,000 property, which is likely to be a flat in that area. She's going to have exactly the same issues. And hopefully, or you'd like to think, if it was a housing association, then they would. They do have some restrictions in terms of raising rents, etc. But the interesting thing is that typically housing associations and the social sector will raise rents in line with inflation plus a little bit extra. In the private rented sector, rents tend to rise with wages, which, as they're not rising anything like in line with inflation, we found that private rents have risen at a lower rate than, in actual fact, social rents have, all those associated with it, like shared ownership. And that's one of the reasons why shared ownership, people that go from private rented sector to shared owner, are shocked that the rent goes up every single year by maybe 3, 4, 5%. So you've got 3% inflation now, you add on another half or 1%, that would be a 4% increase in the rent year on year. Whereas we know that rents in London at the moment are probably on a downward trend as opposed to an upward trend. So that's one of the reasons why. But having said that, what you're doing is you're securing your tenure. And I think what Laura really needs to sit down and do, because I think she's gone into everything in really great detail, but it's almost into so much detail, she's convinced herself out of everything. And I think what she needs to do is look at the pros and cons of private renting, pros and cons of Help to Buy in London, the pros and cons of shared ownership. And also, I know that it's lovely to be next to your family, and I know it's lovely to have your son staying in the same school, but the kids are the most resilient people in this world. And if she moved a little bit further away, she could probably buy a really nice place, possibly even a house, for her and her son, where she doesn't have the leasehold issues. And you can still get back and see mum and dad or mum really, really quickly. So and they'll get used to a new school. You know, there's a lot of very good London schools. So I think if I were Laura, I'd just stand back a little bit and I'd compare all the options, because she can get herself a good roof over her head. But I think she's put so many restrictions on herself at the moment that it's meant that she's not being able to move forward and get her and her son settled.
Great. And I'm enjoying your life coaching there as well, actually, Kate. I wanted to ask...
Property is life coaching. It's that's effectively what do people need.
Sorry, did you want to come in, Damien?
Sorry, yeah, I just wanted to weigh in on that one. I think, and as I'm of that generation, I think I'm allowed to say it, but I think a lot of the issues that we currently have are all of our own making. So as I think Jay and Kate were mentioning before, first-time buyers, absolutely, you can buy a £90,000 house without too much bother. The problem is they want the £400,000, £500,000, £600,000 house instead, and then they throw the toys out the pram because they can't have exactly what they want. But they've spent the past 10 years buying experiences rather than saving up and investing, ready to put the deposit down on the house. So I know a lot of my sort of friend circle are mid-30s. They've got good jobs, but they can't afford the house they want. They can afford a house. They just refuse to move there, and they're not willing to move, compromise on anything. And they just then bemoan the fact that, well, it's investors' fault that I can't afford what I want. Which, okay, fine, to an extent that might be true. But the only other thing I wanted to pick up on, I think Laura mentioned that she didn't feel the properties that she was looking at were worth the $550 to $650. Now, I work with the government department that came up with Help to Buy many moons ago, and one of the biggest things, one of the biggest reasons for Help to Buy as a whole scheme and system was basically to prop up the house building industry. So they wanted to make sure house builders didn't have to drop their prices dramatically to be able to shift stock. And so they, the government stepped in and said, well, okay, fine, we'll give you, we'll guarantee your mortgage up to 95%, or in this case, we'll give you 20% equity to buy the house. It was almost to artificially keep prices where they shouldn't have been, and the market naturally would have reduced, but the government stepped in to keep them that high up. So I think, yeah, as Kate says, there's always going to be bad eggs out there. But I think Laura does raise a good point of potentially some Help to Buy properties, shared ownership, are artificially inflated and not really worth the money that you're paying for them.
And Jay, can you fill us on? Yes, Jay, can you fill us in on Laura's options in terms of finance for shared ownership?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with the vast majority of what Kate said, and Damien. It's a tricky one because, as I said, there are three issues here that Laura seems to have. One being the service charge, which will be associated to any leasehold apartment and some leasehold houses for that matter. I think the difficult thing for Laura is she's clearly grown up in a house and has been used to living in a house. And even her mother has downsized recently, from what I understand, and gone to an apartment. So whether she goes down the road of shared ownership or Help to Buy, there's always going to be a service charge. Two, the rent issue, I understand that. That's such a genuine concern, and I understand why she'd be concerned. Three, the new build premium. The new build premium, is it too much? Is she paying too much? Damien makes a good point. Whenever the precursor to Help to Buy, shared equity scheme, a lot of those schemes were to prop up. We saw it in Manchester and Liverpool. A lot of those schemes were to prop up sites that would have gone under, where major house builders were being underpinned by major banking groups that I won't name today. And it smacked of artificially high values. I hope that's not the case anymore, given the fact that market's a lot more resilient than what it was back in the days of 2009-2010. But there was another issue that puts people off shared ownership that Laura didn't mention, which I come across a lot. A lot of people don't like the idea of purchasing a property. Let's say in Laura's case, she was purchasing, I know she said 30, but let's say 25% of a £500,000 property. Well, then she owns 25% of that property, so that's fine. So 25% of that property is £125,000 value, and the local authority or the shared ownership housing association owns £375,000. Whenever you go to staircase up, as they put it, staircasing, where you want to jump to 50% or 62.5% or 75%, you then have to pay the market value. And of course, if the market value of that property has gone up, well, then you're going to have to pay more for that equity stake in the property than what you would have had to pay at the original point of purchase. And that leaves a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths, which is why I firmly believe there is a good place for shared ownership for people who genuinely, A, cannot purchase a property outright, B, Help to Buy won't work for them because Help to Buy is better than shared ownership. And then, as I said, then you'd move on to shared ownership. Now, on that, there are plenty of lenders out there, plenty of major market leaders out there, the likes of Santander, Nationwide, Barclays, Halifax, that will offer very, very competitive shared ownership mortgages. It's not a big deal for them. Where people tend to find they become very expensive is whenever they only have a very small deposit. As a rule of thumb, if you want to go down the shared ownership road and you want a competitive mortgage, you really do need a 10 to 15% deposit. But a lot of people that use shared ownership perhaps are looking for 100% funding of their equity stake in the property, or 95% funding. Then that only leaves a couple of lenders, and the rates, well, they more than double in a lot of instances. But she has options.
Okay, well, let me ask you one last question, Kate, about generational unfairness. How much political pressure do you think is building up, and are government policies addressing it adequately?
I think it's a complete myth. I don't think there's any generational unfairness whatsoever. I think that what we're trying to do is compare the finances of somebody who is 50, 60 and towards the end of their life and starting to go into sort of pension age, potentially having to fund that for the next 30, 40 years, versus somebody at the start of their life in the 20s. I don't see the point in that. All that does is make everybody miserable, quite frankly. And if you think about it, if you're in your 20s, you're using roads, you're using hospitals, you'll be flying off, you know, to various places if you're lucky enough to do that. Well, those things are there because the generation, the older generation, built them for you and their taxes paid them for you. So I really hate, with quite a passion, I'm trying to hold it in, this idea that there is generational unfairness. Because if there is a generational unfairness, what it is that the it's not looking at house price growth or rental growth, because rents are not skyrocketing, rents are not extortionate, they're actually extraordinary good value for money. And there's no statistical evidence whatsoever to say otherwise. But what you are looking at is that since 2000, for the first time, wage growth, what companies pay people, minimum wage, benefits, etc., have not kept pace with general house price inflation, and even sometimes with rental inflation, although that typically does move in line with wages. So actually, the issue for those in their 20s and 30s is you don't get the job security that perhaps our previous generation get, but you do get a loo inside your house, which they didn't have. Secondly, you're not getting wage growth moving in line with inflation or even beating it or keeping up, say, with house prices. So, good example, government want to improve home ownership. They're blaming lack of home ownership on buy-to-let investors, and therefore they're saying, right, we'll take them out of the market. One of the biggest reasons I think home ownership fell in London, for example, in the last 10 years, is because they put a 1% pay cap on the public sector, who would typically good people to own a home, and they did that during a time when prices in those areas went up by 40 to 80%. That is a wage issue. It's not necessarily an inflation issue in house prices, because we've had much worse inflation in the past. So I don't believe in this idea that there is a generational unfairness. Every generation has hard times. I paid 10 to 15% mortgages in my day. I didn't have to pay a big deposit. So there's an example of where generational unfairness has switched.
Oh, Kate, we could talk about this for hours, but
I feel better for getting that out my system.
Yes, on that somewhat controversial response to the question, very interesting. And if people have comments, do get in touch with us through the website, which is insideproperty.org.uk. But that's it for this programme. My thanks to my guests, Kate Faulkner, Damien Fogg and Jay Rooney, and to you for listening. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.